we were fighting over who gets to control things, and I won. Actually, and this is about tools books. So we're going to have a little conversation up here, and then we'll open up to questions after about, I think, half an hour or so. I have been reading Charlie Wilson's War. Yeah, it's in the news, whatever. And it's about this guy, Charlie Wilson, right, who's this sort of larger-than-life guy. He's 6'7". He wears cowboy hats and hand-tooled cowboy boots, which make him 7 feet, and he has a big, moving voice, and he's this sort of larger-than-life heroic character. And that book is an example of a certain kind of nonfiction narrative, which is the heroic narrative, right? This one guy, this iconoclast, this guy who didn't fit anywhere, this guy who everyone thought was this sort of loser outcast, turns out to turn history around. And in every, you can find this example, this kind of narrative, in every form, in every genre, in nonfiction, right? There's, we all know about the educational heroic narrative, Jaime Escalante, right? The teacher who, all by himself, manages to turn around. And in medicine, it's a very familiar trope. The great, the legendary doctor who won't give up, won't say no, who sees something no one else sees. Your colleague at the New Yorker, Jerry Krugman, writes a lot of heroic narratives about medicine. You don't. You are, in fact, you're the king of the unheroic narrative. And so I was in order to kind of verify this.
Oh, in order to sometimes potentially boring, dangerously skirting the edge.
We're going to get into this. We're going to get into this. But Better, which I think is a brilliant book, goes to extraordinary lengths to avoid heroic narratives, even when you're talking about heroes, right? Like Virginia Apgar, and we'll get to that. But before we go any further, question number one: am I right? And if so, why is Atul Gawande the king of the unheroic narrative?
You are right. I don't trust heroes. And there's a reason that strategically I decided to start the book with a piece about how making surgery goes well boils down to making sure you wash your hands at the beginning, which is partly that you convinced me that this was a good story to tell when we were talking about it. We'll put that aside. But also because I'm convinced that the best surgeons I know are ordinary people who can do extraordinary things because, not that they're special, but that they are set up to be able to do extraordinary things. So they are in a place where they can recognize their failures. They're in a place where they can look at the patterns and figure out what's going on and dissect it all. And then they come out looking like heroes as a consequence. Because you saved a life. This is great. But it is so fundamentally impossible without the whole structure around you that propelled you forward. And the best way I can explain this is when the Yankees put together a team, they go out and buy the best possible talent they can find anywhere in the world. They don't make them. The way we hire and find talent at Harvard is we take kids who we have never seen operate ever before. We put them through 10 years of training. We mainly are asking if they're willing to do this really boneheaded thing day in, day out, over and over and over again until they are going to get it right. And anybody who survives that process with a decent sense of humor and that you're willing to, spend time with, we will hire. And they'll look like the best surgeons in the world.
Yeah, I'm still tripping over a little bit the philosophical divide you see between the Yankees and Harvard. But I would have to do the same. But I want to go back to something. You don't trust heroes because
I don't think that narrative is right.
Go on. What do you mean?
So what is a hero? Let me ask you. What to you is a hero?
Well, I'm Mr. Heroic Narrative. All I do is heroic narrative. So, although I tend to agree with you, and I sort of feel slightly guilty when I do heroic narratives, but they're just a lot more fun. We're going to get to the fun in a moment. But what is a hero? Well, I guess you know, I don't know. I mean, I like the idea. I'm very, very sympathetic to the idea that a hero is someone who is as much produced by his or her environment as, you know, as simply the product of individual effort and
Well, but that's different. I mean, a hero comes from somewhere, but still goes on to save the day single-handedly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I don't trust even that.
You don't trust... Because you think that kind of story is fictional. It
doesn't bear up to me under very much scrutiny. That is, maybe I haven't looked enough at the heroic cases, and maybe I'm constitutionally drawn to the cases where there's success despite an absence of heroes. Mm-hmm. You know, I think most success happens despite the fact that there are not heroes making it happen.
Yeah.
When you look across the country and see that there are 4 million child deliveries a year, and that we did that, and that that would have been the most dangerous experience a woman would have had in her lifetime up until about 50 years ago. And now, in the last year, fewer than 500 women died in childbirth. That didn't happen because of the single-handed success of a hero. That happened because really ordinary people were somehow able to do something incredibly competently everywhere it was done. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be more relevant to our lives and more and fundamentally more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think you were attracted to that kind of unheroic stance?
I mean, because something... I'm not a hero.
No. I'm wondering if you can be a little introspective with us. Is there something about you and where you grew up, or who your parents are, or where you come from, that has fed into that way of? It's not a very American way of looking at the world, is it?
No. I'm sure it does. I grew up in a small town in Ohio, the son of two ordinary doctors, and in Athens, Ohio, I definitely grew up as someone who tried to come from the periphery in to belong, and there was plenty to set you apart. Two doctors for parents in one of the poorest areas of the country. When ABC News came to film from Appalachia, they came to our hometown and filmed from there. I'm the son of the two richest, you know, the richest family in town. My parents drove a Mercedes in Appalachia. You know? You are not getting dates at age 14, 15. I've spoken to Malcolm before about how my theory is you can explain most people by who they could or couldn't date when they were 14 years old.
That's your next book? Or is
that might be. If I can weasel into something about human experimentation, I'll be there. And so trying to dive in as the guy who is going to be the captain of the football team getting to wow everybody and bring everybody home, you know, those are not naturally people that I look to figuring out how to become. What I'm interested in looking at how you become is just one of the people who get to belong in that world and do all right in it. And I suppose that could be a reasonable psychological narrative I could make up for you along the way.
I mean, there's I'm reminded of these wonderful experiments that Richard Nisbet and others have done where, do you know about the aquarium experiments?
No.
Okay, so you show people a video of an aquarium that has a really large fish, lots of little fishes, and lots of rocks and little shrubbery and whatever it is are underneath the water. And you have them watch this for 10 seconds. Then you have them write down everything they saw. And then you ask them what they saw. And you show this to a group of American students and they'll say, what did you see? I saw a big fish in a pond. And then they write down like 10 other things that they remember. Show this to somebody from the East, say a college student in China, or Japan or whatever. And they will say, what did you see? I saw a pond with some fish in it. And then look at the list of things they write down. And they write down not 10 things, but 40 things, literally four times as many things. And they're constantly drawing relationships among the things. So they don't just say, I saw a little fish and a big fish. They say, I saw a big fish chasing a little fish. Right? They're constantly, now that's and his argument is that our ways of, you know, if you say, I saw a big fish in a pond, that's the heroic interpretation of the pond.
Right.
It's about a big fish. The unheroic stance is to say, I saw lots of fish, right, in this thing called a pond. His argument is that that's something fundamental about a Western culture, that we look at a scene and we immediately extract the heroic lesson and refuse to see the pattern of relationships that surround the big fish.
It could make sense that as someone whose parents are definitely from an unheroic stance in the world, my father is one of 13 brothers and sisters, most of whom are still farming in a village in India, that it is the amalgamation of the American and the East that I'm trying to wind my way through to make that narrative come together. I think, though, that you do this in your work without needing that Eastern influence. As much as you're writing about the heroic narratives, you are, with Blink or Tipping Point, trying to ask the question again, how sometimes heroes can have that intuitive success, but what you're really getting at is how can regular people have that and have that happen for them? Or 6 degrees of Lois Weisberg. It's the hero in the rough that you didn't realize makes the world really work.
It just means that I'm working harder to find heroes. It doesn't mean that I'm opposed to them.
But I think you can see it. In other words, the complexity is that we all want there to be heroes that we can turn to. At the same time, none of us want to believe that success is not possible without heroes. Mm-hmm. That is, we need life to be successful and things like the medical world to be successful, despite the fact that the people you meet are annoying and tell bad jokes and don't seem to know the answers to all the questions that you ask. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an element that we're not as diametrically opposed on as you might come at it. Perhaps you're coming from the hero and recognizing the complexity that lies underneath. I'm coming underneath and seeing sometimes some heroes.
I mean, the difference between your writing and mine is something I was going to get to in a second, which has to do with the way the actual writing, the stories are told, or less the thinking than the way the stories are told. But before we get to that, I just wanted to make one other comment, and that is, I was wondering to what extent that the heroic narrative applied to medicine, to what extent does that screw up our medical system? That is to say, is the expectation that what you really want as a patient is to find this one in a million physician, does that stand in the way of a better healthcare system?
It does if we internalize it. If we think we're gods, then you're screwed. And there is this cultural revolution taking place now that where medicine is beginning to change. And that is almost generational. You can't make anything work in medicine anymore without having a dozen, two dozen, three dozen people making everything go appropriately. I'll give an example. You go into a hospital, you've got a pneumonia, and you need to be there for a few days on an antibiotic. So, who saved your life? It is the person who diagnosed you with the antibiotic and said, let's give you this antibiotic, and I'm going to make it the right one, and then they make you well. And that's the version we'd always thought of. But we now recognize that there are 4 steps to making a pneumonia go well. You have to have the right antibiotic. It needs to be given, if it's severe enough to put you in the hospital, it needs to be given within 4 hours of your arrival. You need to get a blood culture so we can know before the antibiotic goes in whether the bacteria have spread throughout your body. And we need to give you oxygen. What's the likelihood in an American hospital you'll get all 4 put together? It's only 50%. But there's a bell curve. There are hospitals that do it more than 90% of the time. There are hospitals that do it less than 30% of the time. And that hospital that does it 90% of the time, they don't have smarter doctors than anybody else. And they don't have people working later than anybody else. They have more people who can make the mundane, idiotic details go right. It's not that they have more people. They just have people who can do that. And plumbing and understanding why the more lives get saved in that circumstance is where I think that comes from. So I drifted off your question.
No, you've answered lovely, in a beautiful way. But follow up to that, is, I'm thinking of your malpractice chapter in Better, because that's also part of what's wrong with our attitude about malpractice, right? That you extract one player from a chain, a chain of causation, and from an environment where many people are involved, and you try and pin the blame on that player. Doesn't that feed the same kind of notion that what medicine is a discrete series of events rather than a process?
Yes. There is, in fact, this whole school of liability called enterprise liability, which the country has resisted, which is the idea that you no longer hold the physician responsible and sue them, but instead, if your doctor makes a bad diagnosis, it's the whole enterprise that was responsible for having let them make that bad diagnosis and had a system in place without, say, checklists or various things that could make it less likely to happen. And I think that that is closer to where the truth of the matter is. Now, I also think that you still end up driving the problems under the rug by saying that the solution to everything is that you sue about it. But the ways in which we screw ourselves up with the heroic narrative are two things. Number one is, if the public thinks that we're heroes, we're going to be bound to disappoint when we fail, and we're gonna fail. And so what we have to do to succeed is be completely forthright about the failures and then look at the patterns and be able to say, okay, next year we might fail a little less than last year. It's not terribly sexy to say that, but you know, that was the problem at Walter Reed. Walter Reed, when the scandal hit where soldiers were getting poor care, was a place where they would not measure themselves. And if there were measurements, no one wanted to talk about it or publicize it because it just made the military look bad. That failure, that need to be the heroes, drove the ability to discuss the fact that they weren't completely underground.
I want to ask a question about the writing of some of these stories, because this is also where this comes up. So the chapter you have, for example, on Virginia Apgar, I was looking at it. This perhaps is a little inside writerly baseball, if you don't mind. So I thought to myself, how would I have written that chapter? So I don't know how many of you have read the book, but there's a chapter on this woman named Virginia Apgar who, it could plausibly be argued, has saved as many lives in the 20th century as maybe anyone else?
No. I mean, this was a person, yes.
So she's the one, explain who she is, just for those who...
Virginia Apgar is this fascinating, great woman, a kind of hero to me. She's from New York City. She was actually a surgeon who made her big breakthrough in childbirth. She was the first, I don't know if you want me to go into this great detail, but I love her so much, I have to tell you. She was the first woman to graduate from the Columbia Surgery Training Program. It was 1937. And Alan Whipple, the chairman at the time, told Virginia Apgar, you know, you're a fine surgeon, Ginny, but no one's going to send you patients because you're a woman. And so why don't you join us as an anesthesiologist, which was at that time a lower status profession. And so she felt she had a little choice, but she said yes. But if you knew anything about her, she was the kind of person who was not about to let that just sit there and do nothing. She was tall. She was the kind of person who got her pilot's license in her 50s and was reputed to have flown illegally under the George Washington Bridge. She carried a knife and tubing in her purse so that in case anybody choked on the street, she could give them a tracheotomy or intubate them, and she did it more than a dozen times in the streets of New York City. She used to steal wood from the hallways because she not only was a concert level violinist, she was so unhappy with the quality of workmanship that she made her own violins. So you just hired this person as anesthesiologist, and within 3 years she had made it its own division, and about 5 years after that had gotten it to be its own department where the surgeons could have no say whatsoever about what the anesthesiologist had to do. And then having done that, she entered the world of obstetrics, which was her great love, and as an anesthesiologist to help women with pain during delivery. And what she saw was that children were being born that she thought could live and the obstetricians thought they couldn't. They would be small, and they would be blue, and they couldn't move, or they would just be limp. And so they'd give up on the small baby or a baby with a birth defect, put it in the corner and tell the mom it was a stillbirth and let the baby die. Well, at that time, it was about 1 in 30 ordinary deliveries the baby would die. That means that, you know, in among friends you knew, you know, it would be not an uncommon experience that people would have a healthy baby just die. It was part of life. She needed to change those doctors to recognize that they had a baby that could live, and she was convinced of it. But how do you do that when you're an anesthesiologist on the other end of the bed, don't know, you know, don't have any professional standing in obstetrics, and you're a woman in a man's world? What she came up with was very sly and psychological. She came up with a score, the Apgar score, which rates the health of babies at birth from 1 to 10. If they're pink and moving all their limbs and crying and screaming, and they get a 9 or a 10, and that means that they're going to live. But if they have a score of less than 5, then they're blue and they're limp, and they could die unless you do something about it. And having created that score, it forced people, just by rating, to actually look at the babies and realize that some of them were actually healthier than you thought. Second of all, she then showed that if you have a score less than 5, you don't just pat them on the back or, you know, try to warm them up in a warmer. You intubate them. You breathe for them on a machine. And within 5 minutes, they will get a score that went from 3 to 10, and you can have a baby who's going to live.
10 being the highest.
10 being the highest and the best possible outcome. And then you had this explosion happen. She started to show a couple of things. She showed, for example, that using a spinal or an epidural anesthetic was better than using general anesthesia. In the 50s, general anesthesia was what was commonly done for mothers delivering, and that turned out to depress the breathing of babies and potentially kill them. And she showed that you could make the scores better, and that saved a lot of lives just by itself. But then, within a few years, you had creation of neonatal intensive care units and lots of obstetricians poring over their Apgar results saying, hey, we're going to get better Apgar results than those guys down the block. And suddenly you had, the race was on. And within about 20 years after that, the death rates from delivery had fallen by more than 90%. If we had the death rates from the 1950s for children born today, instead of about 10,000 deaths from 4 million deliveries, it would have been closer to 120,000.
So it is?
And it was night and day, and it became worldwide. It changed the
So it is safe to say that in the list of people in the 20th century, she's probably saved as many lives as anyone. The only person I could think of who might be up there would be, who's the malaria guy, whatever his name was.
Or the Fahey, the guy who delivered on smallpox eradication.
So we're talking about, she's in the top 5 most lives saved of all time.
Yeah. Okay. And you would have written this how?
Yes. Now, I read the Virginia Apgar chapter this afternoon, and it does not resemble in any way what you just said. Right. You totally dialed it down. First of all, you don't get to Virginia Apgar until you start with a story, a story about an ordinary person who's having a delivery, right? We get very interesting, fascinating. We do that for 3,000 words. Then we get to Virginia in a very truncated form. None of that stuff about walking around Manhattan like Jenny Bond.
I get that in there, but later.
Oh, later. But not with this kind of big, booming. Nothing about how she saved. Did you say, you don't say she saved as many lives as anyone, which would have been the thing I would have started the whole.
No, you just asked me. I never occurred to me to try to quantify that.
I mean, you know, but so you have a hero. She's a hero. She's like, but you don't treat her.
They made a stamp. I've got that stamp over my desk. The U.S. stamp of Virginia.
Oh, really?
So she is kind of a hero,
she's
too.
She's a hero.
She's
although,
a hero to me.
I'll point out several things about her, because she's a hero in your form, in the sense that she's a hero who creates a mechanism that allows non-heroes to perform better. It's not a...
Exactly.
She produces something that allows others to replicate her record without having her gifts. So it's a certain kind of... Very different sort of hero, because the standard hero is the person who does something we can never hope to do.
Right.
So she does fit your kind of definition, it was very intriguing to me that you chose to write that chapter in a way that played down what was singular about her, or even by the way we don't meet her until we're well into this discussion. Why not? Why not begin the chapter with Virginia Apple?
Because she isn't you. You are the mother about to deliver a baby, like any other mother, and depending on where you are in space and in time, that delivery, I told the story of Liz Rourke, who had a 31-hour labor, and the baby just was not coming out. And, you know, the intensity of arguments around this, I mean, this was, you know, I still get angry letters from people on all sides of what Liz Rourke should have done. In fact, poor Liz got, you know, emails from obstetricians and midwives telling her that when she gets her second baby, they're going to deliver it for her, and she should come to them because she was, but, you know, this is where we are, right? You're about to deliver a baby. You don't know what's going to happen, and what unfolded for her were very ordinary things. The baby doesn't quite go. Should I have an epidural? Should I not have an epidural? That, to me, is the interesting thing, was these decisions that happen when you're in those shoes, and then how little changes in history could mean the difference between this is the most dangerous thing that would ever happen to a woman for nearly all of human history, except for the last 75 years, mm-hmm. and having this be, you know, a routine delivery in America, C-section. Guess what?
No, I'm not. I was. I'm admiring of it, and I am appreciative of how it would never have occurred to me if I wrote that chapter to put her in the middle. She would have been right up front, and I would have given you pages and pages on it, and then we would have gotten to the ordinary story. You know, after I was quite sure you were hooked.
You would have had what's the alpha? What's the dog whisperer? You would have had the dog whisperer up front. I would have started with the dog.
Yes.
In fact, I would have started the dog whisperer. I can tell you, I would start the dog whisperer with our dog, which we just got 16 weeks ago. Where you got, you know, you're the family with the dog trying to figure out how the heck you control this thing, because it is crazy. And then you get the dog, then a third of the way through, maybe halfway through, you might get the dog whisperer. But I'd want to decode, you know, isn't he just... You know, aren't there lots of people like the dog whisperer who actually do the same thing, just don't have a TV show?
It's funny because these are different. When you were describing why you think about things that way, you said, well, I was a child of outsiders in a small town in the middle of nowhere, right? Well, I too am a child of outsiders who grew up in a small town in the middle of nowhere, and I had exactly the opposite reaction.
And you were in Canada.
What's that?
And not only in the middle of nowhere, it was Canada.
Exactly. You know, way down the bottom. Appalachia was like the French Riviera to us. But my reaction to that was exactly the opposite. In other words, I found the experience of being an outsider in a small town so unbelievably boring. All I wanted to do was hear stories about fabulous, exciting people and exalt them. I mean, I don't know what that says, but just that maybe there are other more meaningful differences between us that we can't...
Thank God it's a little bit different. That way people can feel like the New Yorker is not giving them the same damn story over and over.
We may be... What time is it?
It's 7:35.
Should we ask a couple more questions? And then we'll
all right. One or two more, and then
okay.
Give people a chance.
My other questions were... I don't know whether I wanted to stick with this heroic thing. Maybe we've minded. I really wanted you to talk a lot more about why you thought where you came from shaped your attitude towards this thing, but maybe you don't want to go on.
You know, but my wife thinks this is crazy, but I don't think where I came from made it. Here's my theory. Are you ready for my theory? One of my favorite books in the world is This Boy's Life. You know This Boy's Life, Tobias Wolff's narrative? It's the story of a 10-year-old in Concrete, Washington, who one day, his mother is a single mother with this malevolent boyfriend who beats him up all the time. And he decides one day that he was meant for a better life. And so he goes out, steals a bunch of stationery from his school, makes up a fabulous transcript and some glowing letters of recommendation, sends it off to Deerfield Academy, and gets himself admitted on full scholarship there. He arrives, he puts himself through, he gets to go to Princeton, and he becomes just who he wanted to be. He could invent himself on the spot. But mainly, it wasn't that he could just invent himself. What he did was he took himself and he put himself in a different environment that was going to shape his choices and shape his options in the world and make possibilities that he was never otherwise going to have. And it allowed him to sort of escape. He didn't completely escape. His drunk real father comes out of the woodwork and by the end of the book and makes life miserable for him, and he realizes that he's not completely out from under it all. Another person who was like that is Ernest Hemingway. Hemingway was the son of a prominent Chicago surgeon. His father thought he should be a doctor, just like all doctors think their children should be. And he was determined that he was not going to get to do that. So he removed himself at age 18 to expatriate Paris, where he could immerse himself in an entirely different world with an entirely different set of possibilities. And he emerged from there exactly what he couldn't have been in that Chicago environment, which is the writer. Now, of course, his first stories were the short stories of, young Nick up in Northern Peninsula, Michigan, son of a surgeon, trying to escape out from under his shadow. But he was able to somewhat move on. And what I got to have, and what I think, in a way, you got to have, were opportunities because of who our parents were and so on, that could remove us from our worlds and open up the possibilities of the world in ways that were completely flabbergasting. For me, it was getting to go to a college like Stanford, where from a small town in Ohio, you met people who saw possibilities in the world you didn't even know existed. Doing an internship on Capitol Hill, going to work at a magazine, and I barely was reading magazines at this point. It just was unbelievable. Work at the radio station, work at the college newspaper. That experience is, I think, part of what's so incredibly fundamentally American, that you can reshape your existence by putting yourself in different environments and getting to do something differently. And that, to me, is the more powerful shape. Now, what drives you to dump you out and give that other environment a try still feels fundamentally inexplicable to me.
On that note of inexplicability, we'd be delighted to answer any for anyone who has questions. Throw it up.
Malcolm as well.
Yes. Yeah, I really knew nothing about Virginia Apgar until tonight, and have not read the book. But I'm just curious. When she came up with the scale, how did she get people to pay attention to the scale, to use the scale?
Yeah, I've been trying to piece this together. Because within about 3 years, it was worldwide. So, at the end of that chapter, I say, we need an Apgar score for psychiatry patients, right? So that you can know at the end of the session whether this patient is going to be depressed for the rest of their lives or not, or whether you're making any headway. Are Americans, are we doing better at treating depression in 2008 than in 2005? We don't know. And of course, I thought, well, in surgery, at the end of an operation, can I say if things are going to go well or not? And the answer is, I tell my patients that it all went fine, as I usually do, because I don't completely know. So we came up with the Apgar score, and I've called it the surgical Apgar score, which was just based on the amount of blood you lost during the operation and your heart rate and your blood pressure during the surgery. And it turned out it was great. It was incredibly predictive of your likelihood you will die in the next 30 days after the operation. If you got a 9 or a 10, we have zero deaths after 6,000 patients, meaning you had blood loss less than 100 cc's, were stable. And as it creeps up to greater than a score of less than 5, 16% chance of death. It's been about 2 years since I published that. It's not exactly everywhere. I think...
Do you know where it is? Has it spread at all?
It's spread some. It's in little pockets here and there. So, for example, I found out that Kaiser Hospitals in California are using it a little bit to try to see if they can understand how their patients are doing. And there turned out to be a hospital in Tanzania that's it's little pockets here and there. I mean, Virginia Apgar's, it was everywhere, half the world by the time. And I think it was because people were asking hard questions about why all these kids are dying. You're talking about something that is pervasive in life in every world, And then you had somehow had the profession of obstetrics ready for it. They saw themselves as having a job in a different way than surgeons look at themselves. Obstetricians see themselves as keepers of public health. That is, I'm not just delivering this child right now. I have to make sure that I'm part of a system that will make sure that 4 million children are delivered with the best possible outcomes that they can have. Surgeons don't think that way. We don't think, you know how many operations we do in this country? We do 40 million operations in this country with a 3% death rate compared to that one, a 3% major complication rate. It's one of the largest causes of disability in the country. But no surgeon says, boy, we're responsible for a lot that goes wrong in this country. How do we make sure I'm part of something that makes that less? So there was, I think, a cultural difference that she sent that score out into.
I think maybe she had a gold star like in Malcolm's book, To Be Guided. My question is about the gentleman who runs he was a pediatric clinic.
Yes, Warren Warwick and cystic fibrosis.
I think there's a hero you might want to talk about. It. I don't remember. It seemed like he was a bit more the center of that story.
Did you think that was a heroic narrative? I can tell the story briefly. But
it's a heroic narrative in the sense that, once again, though, it is someone who is extraordinary, but his extraordinariness allows others, ordinary people, to be extraordinary. I mean, it's a kind of, again, it's the replication of extraordinary behavior is what he's interested in, not.
Yeah. This is a pediatric pulmonologist who specializes in care for kids with cystic fibrosis, deadly genetic disease. We have no cure for it. And in his clinics, they live 14 years longer than the average 33 years that the clinics elsewhere get. He's just simply at the top of the bell curve. And what's striking to me about it is not just that he can take care of individuals, and it is amazing to watch him in a clinic appointment with a 17-year-old girl who refuses to take her medications because she's rebelling, and how he gets her to do that, but that he's part of a team of 7 pulmonologists where he's got to have them all taking care of their kids with that much ability, and watching how he does that, and then how other places come to learn from what he does and start doing it themselves. That I thought was the really cool part of the story.
Doctor, I read your book. I found it so interesting because you always mention four historical events anytime when you describe your, for example, of in obstetrics about the forceps, how you go back to this, how it was developing, and the person was hiding from the rest of the world. That was fascinating. Also, I noticed that you described the war in Afghanistan, how life soldiers nowadays are rate of survival is much greater than many other wars that this country faces. And can you talk a little bit about these different changes now in medicine that is used in the event of war and improvising and surviving rate on all these soldiers? Because you notice that there, you describe very nicely when you say platoons of officers now, they are going with the, into a battle, and they are kind of transfer patients from one side to the other, and everyone is getting the share of proper care. And they're at the end, they're developing a much greater survival rate than each soldiers, which I believe is very nice. I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you for that question. So this is a chapter where I'm looking at how the military saves soldiers. Because what's interesting about it is at the end of the Persian Gulf War, the survival rate for soldiers who'd been blown up by bombs or hit by snipers was about 75%, 25% died. And in this current war, the death rate is now below 10%. So how did they do that? Was it because there's a new technology for saving people blown up by bombs? No. Compared to 15 years ago, it's not any different. We still save people the same way. Is it because they hired more talented surgeons, the greatest trauma surgeons in the country? No. No, in fact, they are having problems recruiting people and having to task plastic surgeons to do trauma surgery because, you know, last year, for example, only 15 surgeons signed up to join the Army, and they were there were many more than that that were leaving at that time. So what it turned out to be was, and you'll recognize the theme here, it's starting to come out, was that there was a group of people who simply tracked and measured how many soldiers died last week. If you can go on the Department of Defense website and you can see within 48 hours how many soldiers were wounded, how many died. You cannot do that for an American hospital. You can't go in and ask, last week, how many died, how many had complications. Let alone, you couldn't do that for 2 years ago. So then, of course, we don't. If you don't know it, we don't know it. And they know it in the military. And what they did with that information was not just track it. They would ask, okay, now, given those failures, well, given that, they wouldn't say, oh, we had a 90% success. They'd say, we had a 10% failure. How do we change that? What is the cause of that? And it does get down to these mundane details. They found, for example, that they had a slew of soldiers who were blinded at the beginning of the war, tons by shrapnel and so on, and they thought that the goggles weren't working. But it turned out that the goggles weren't working because they weren't wearing them. The soldiers said they looked like, you know, kinds of glasses senior citizens wore, was now the soldier that I spoke to put it. And so the guys who were the statistical keepers went to the Army and said, we have to contract with Wiley to buy cool-looking ballistic eyewear. And now you go on eBay and you can buy these glasses. They're you know, worth $500 to $1,000 because every soldier wants to wear them all the time. And the blinding injuries have gone down enormously. What did you see there? You saw diligence in the sense that there was attention to detail and a willingness to find the failures by tracking and looking at their statistics. And you saw ingenuity of a kind that we don't normally think about, which is, how can I be creative in figuring out how to change the pattern of what people do? And you know, you don't think of that as a normal medical job, but it was a surgeon who sat around trying to puzzle over, you know, how do I get soldiers to wear these granny goggles, as they called them? And the answer was, you can't. You can't get 18-year-olds to put these things on, so let's get them some cool stuff, and it'll change everything. Yes.
You talked about the normal distribution of hospitals. And to somebody outside the medical community, it feels quite mind-boggling that you have Six Sigma across corporations, you have throughputs for laptops being manufactured to a certain degree of accuracy, your automobiles, and it's quite amazing to know that there is no one body that monitors the Six Sigma of hospitals. Where would it come from?
So the question for those of you who couldn't hear it is that industry sits there worrying about Six Sigma, which is the idea that you can limit mistakes to less than 1 in 3 million. And meanwhile, in medicine, you have no one even trying to track and look at the statistics. And we already know that 1 out of 50 patients will have a major error that leaves them injured in a hospital, that occurs on a regular basis. I'd be curious to ask Malcolm, because I think you understand some of these cultural issues more. What's your perspective on why there would be such a difference between the industrial world perspective and the medical world, where, you know, people hear about Six Sigma and just say that's crazy in the medical world?
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful. I don't know if I have a good answer. It is a wonderful question, and it actually I was going to ask you this question. Which maybe touches on this, which is, given your conclusions in a roundabout way, as this question does address your question, given your conclusions about what medicine needs, which is attention to detail, transparency, and your veneration of diligence and these kinds of qualities, do we recruit and train doctors the right way? That is to say, it strikes me that almost everything we do when we come to time to choosing doctors is zeroes in on their intellectual capacity, right? And what you're suggesting is that actually you're not as interested in how smart you are. What you really care about is how conscientious they are, how diligent they are. And the reason, perhaps one of the reasons why industry has been much quicker to embrace some of these things is that there isn't, you know, the business world of America does not recruit and track people based on one criteria, right? They're not just interested in the most brilliant. They're interested in people with a range of different personal and characteristics. And I'm wondering, could we solve a lot of this if we recruited a different kind of person into medicine?
I think that's right at a core sense. That is, there is a kind of myth-making that goes on even at the admission level to the kind of people that you're bringing in, that they will be the heroes. Yeah. Where what you need is a sense that you're bringing in people who are creative enough to make successes out of other people and everybody around them. And business does take that as a core attribute, that you know, it's not enough that you have someone come in who can be the prima donna. In fact, in some cases, that scene is quite counterproductive unless you want to run Sunbeam. The rest of the medical world is grappling with this. I think we're coming around. You know, the problem is that we call it teamwork. We want team players now. We want to recruit people who've, you know, worked in group environments. But I don't think that's quite right either. What you want is to bring people in who you then equip to do this. I sort of belittled it in a little way towards the end, where I talk about the idea that we want people who simply can count something and then make a change as a consequence of it and then write about it. So I say, you know, it doesn't really matter what you count, it just has to be something interesting, but you know, that you count the number of complications you have or how long you made your patients wait in the operating room, whatever it is that might be interesting to you, and then you work on trying to make an improvement in it. And then comes this last part, which is that you got to write about it. You got to make it known to the world. There are all kinds of barriers to that happening. Number one, people don't conceive of themselves as scientists of the everyday world in that way, and they aren't trained to do that in medicine. But the other thing is there are actual barriers to it. I mean, one guy I wrote about recently in the New Yorker in December is Peter Pronovost, an anesthesiologist who came up with a basic checklist that could prevent infections. And the way the checklist worked was it just said, look, when you put an IV into somebody, a central line as it's called, that you have to make sure you wash your hands, you put on a mask and glove and gown, that you used a chlorhexidine soap. And if you did all these things, then he found that the infection rate, and he did it in an entire state, in Michigan, went down by two-thirds. 1,500 people a year were saved. He saved more than $200 million for the state. And then what happened? So it was my puzzle at the end of the piece, and I thought I was being too negative. I said, you know, why a year and a half after this have we not embraced this? Why do we not have Robert Jarvik on television saying that there is this thing out there that will save more lives than any drug we've got available for trying to make infections go away in hospitals? And obviously one answer is you can't make a profit on it. But another answer turns out to be that in our particular world, we're not ready to embrace it. Spain is running away with the idea. They're going to put it in every single hospital. What was the federal government response? They shut down the program in Michigan, saying it was unethical because they hadn't asked the permission of patients about the use of the checklist. The program only worked because they tracked, they didn't ask the permission of the patients and the doctors. The program only worked, you could create the piece of paper, but it wouldn't get used. What Pronovost did was he monitored how many of the ICU doctors actually used the checklist and then whether the infection rates went down. So he would tell them, you know, you guys are only using it a third of the time, you should be using it 100% of the time, and they would look bad. And it had a very powerful effect. Well, the arguments were that patients should have control over the kind of care they have, and if this is an experiment changing their care, they should be given the option to opt out of the experiment. And that physicians and nurses also are potentially having their privacy violated and it could affect them financially, could affect them emotionally, to find out that they are not living by 20th century standards of hygiene. And it's become this huge, huge fight because the idea of measuring ourselves, publicizing that data, letting it get around, is regarded as something that we just don't ordinarily do. There's resistance at the professional level because we are scared about what happens if you look honestly at what happens to our own results. I'd be scared about my own results. I'm still a young enough surgeon to know that a lot of surgeons are better than I am. And worry that someone will punish me when they see the reality of my results. But at the same time, I know there's no way I can get better until I see who really is the best at what I do and how I can learn from it. And then there's this other layer that says that looking at our data starts to get at something very dangerous to us as Americans. It starts to get at our privacy and potentially unearth something that we want control over.